just about everybody in the relevant sectors of academia and of serious thought in this country, and I think in the Western world now or shortly, is discussing the book recently published by Harvey Mansfield of Harvard University. It is titled quite directly, a single word for the title, Manliness, and it's published by Yale University Press. Would a proper epigraph have been, male and female created he them?
Oh, I just wanted to use that single word, manliness. It's a word that's gone out of favor, and I want to bring it back.
It's gone out of favor, replaced by what instead?
Masculinity, machoism, more derogatory words. Manliness has something fine-sounding about it.
Oh, it does indeed.
Yeah.
Some of this begins, I know, with your comment about, was it somebody recently deceased who had been a colleague of yours?
Or that's right.
Or recently retired or something?
Recently retired, yes.
And you said, in response to somebody inquiring for some publication, you said of him?
Yeah. We all respected him because of his manliness.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a silence at the other end of the phone, and finally the female voice said, well, could you think of another word?
Was she writing for the New York Times?
No, she was writing for the Harvard Alumni Magazine.
Oh, really?
And I love this story, and I've told it 1,000 times because I think it illustrates how the gender-neutral society got spread around through language, through the correction of language, through the phrase is raising consciousness, and it was done by putting to sleep such words as manliness.
But you mentioned gender-neutral society now. We all know, our students all know, or lots of our academic colleagues all know, that is a desirable state of affairs that we have now accomplished.
Yes, we have accomplished it in the sense that the principle of the gender-neutral society has taken over and I think can hardly be challenged now in public or perhaps even in private. And that principle is that the sexes are interchangeable and that society should be a place where your sex matters as little as possible. And it doesn't give you your rights, your duties, certainly doesn't give you your place. So that's what's been created in principle.
That's a matter of rights and duties, but also as a matter of, quote, science or of knowledge or of deeper and more modern understanding. There are some significant intellectual figures, or were they merely intellectoid figures of our time, who have taught us that gender, as they call it, is largely a, quote, social construction.
I know they say that. I don't think I agree. In my book, I report findings of social psychologists who rather show the contrary. They've studied sex stereotypes in the way that psychologists used to study racial stereotypes. And those who studied racial stereotypes found that they didn't amount to anything. They were mostly prejudice. But sex stereotypes seem to have a good deal of truth in them.
Such stereotypes as?
That men are aggressive and women are caring, that men are promiscuous and women are modest or at least unadventurous in sexual matters, that men boast and show off, women are modest, that women cry and men don't. So men are loud and women are quiet. Men are or laconic, and women loquacious, things like that.
Gee, to the modern person properly conditioned, that set of adjectival comparisons seems to put women in the lead by far.
Well, if you went down the list, I think you would find some in which men are in the lead and others in which women are. And it's true, one shouldn't make a stereotype out of the stereotypes. They aren't so hostile to women as is often thought or commonly reported.
What are the manly virtues?
Boldness, determination, the flip side of which is stubbornness, unwillingness to change, a certain obliviousness, The flip side of that, or the good side of that, of obliviousness, is being able to abstract, to concentrate, to be single-minded. Those, I think, are especially manly attributes, whereas women are more empirical, more realistic. They are more careful, flexible. They adjust better. They're capable in all those ways.
Do we, in this latter day, in a society that has liberalized itself to the point of, I think, intrinsic value confusion, do we, men, suffer the problem of not allowing ourselves to be as manly as our natures would otherwise direct?
I think that's very true, that men are embarrassed to be men now. This, I think, is a principle or the consequence of the gender-neutral society. Men have no justification for being manly, and they just don't know what to do with their inclinations. I call it unemployed manliness. There's a lot of manliness around, which you can see in extreme sports, just taking risks for the sake of taking risks, and also the huge amount of time that men spend with sports, and in other things too, but there's no justification, there's no way in which you can be proud of being a man.
Well, there is, of course, one realm in which manliness is required, I should think, and that is war.
Well, but that's become professional. We've now got a professional army, and professionalism is a way of getting around manliness. There was this nice movie some years ago called Fargo, of a woman police officer who was pregnant and who triumphed against all the men in the movies, in that movie, who were either unmanly or manly in a vicious way.
And her husband is at home drawing pictures of birds.
That's right, for postage stamps.
Right.
Yes. that's right, and she managed because she just followed the rules. So the idea there would be that rule-bound professionalism is can take over from the more manly occupations in which men often show themselves to be somewhat erratic, says women don't fly off the handle as easily.
Yet greater love hath no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friend.
Well, yes, so that's still here. And the desire that men have to do that, and to be protective of those who are weaker, their family, their wife, their children, that's still there as well.
But a great critique, of course, a great critical point that comes up immediately, and that any serious feminist or friend of feminists or modernized person thinking about the dangers of masculinity, I'll call it that now rather than manliness, is the aggressive nature of man as compared to woman, and that often leads us to war.
Yes.
And war is the ultimate burden that the human race carries.
Yes. War and crime. Men are a vast majority of the prison population. So, and men are the ones that start the wars, but also the ones that that fight the good fight. It was men who started the great wars of the 20th century, but also men who put an end to them. So from which one might conclude that manliness is needed against the evils of manliness.
There was nothing that strutted a caricature of manliness more vividly in modern history than, I would think, the Nazi movement, even before it came to power, let alone
It
did its desecrations after achieving power.
These
were street toughs.
Yes.
Who organized and wore the same uniform.
Salutes they had.
Exactly.
The goose-stepping soldiers.
What about that?
Yeah. Well, that's a terrible excess of manliness.
But you would say it is an expression of manliness.
I would, yeah. So I don't say that manliness is simply a virtue. It's a quality which has a good side and a bad side. It can be fashioned into a virtue with refinement and some moral instruction. and good habits and the criticism of a good woman, which is still needed, something that we don't see so much of in the gender-neutral society.
There have been a lot of reviews of your book already. I think it's only been published in the last 2 or 3 months, isn't that right?
Even 1 month.
Only 1 month.
Yeah.
And, of course, the responses are almost predictable, based not so much upon the gender, as they would name it these days, but upon the publication in which the review appears. The Times has written a condescending, mincing dismissal. The National Review thinks this is one of the great books that will last for a long time and will be of great value. And almost all the other reviews are predictable by whether the publication is essentially on the left or on what we might as well then call the right.
I suppose that's true. I am a conservative, but I didn't write this book to rally conservatives and to make them feel good and to bash the left. Actually, I say my addressee is the educated woman, many of whom, most of whom, I suppose, are liberals and are certainly partisans of or beneficiaries of feminism.
And one of the books you you treat a number of important works in manliness. That book by Harvey Mansfield, I repeat again, is just published by Yale University Press. One of the books you devote considerable attention to is Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique.
Yes. 1963, so the founding book of American feminism, following upon Simone de Beauvoir's Second Sex. Interestingly, an attack more on femininity than on manliness. The feminine mystique is femininity, which Betty Friedan says, argues, was foisted on women by men who wanted to make them their slaves. And it's something that women now need to get away from. And in fact, they have got away from that, but they haven't replaced it with anything.
I started doing this radio program many, many years ago. And in my first or second year doing this program, Betty Friedan came to visit. She had done another book. I can't now remember its title, but yes, it was more of the same.
Yes.
I was in those days, I confess, perhaps more a person of the left than I now am, being a very young academic. It was virtually required by the culture, not by the people who hired you. And so I was friendly to her argument. I listened and gave her the proper questions, I suppose. She inscribed the book to me after the program to Milt Rosenberg, a real man.
How funny.
Because
what a striking thing. In other words, she still had that in her mind.
Yeah. Well, I'm not quite sure what she meant by it. She meant a real man who's sensitive to women and their problems.
Well, but also she meant, I think, a real man, a man who's himself.
Maybe
so. And
it
doesn't fit in. And so not totally a sensitive male. But I suppose, she may have had a certain confusion between those two.
Well, later on she had an argument with some of the younger feminists, even with,
yes,
what's her name, the founder of Ms. Magazine?
Gloria Steinem.
Gloria Steinem.
Yes.
About their having gone too far in essentially dismissing family life as of no relevance.
Well, it's what she had done in her book, The Feminine Mystique,
yeah,
using that notorious phrase, concentration camp, to refer to the family. Well, that is feminism having second thoughts, and that's the feminism that we're, for the most part, seeing today. To me, the more radical feminists of the early 70s, more radical even than Betty Friedan, are more interesting because I think they show better what feminism is really about.
Which ones do you have in mind?
Kate Millett and Germaine Greer. Shulamith Firestone is my absolute favorite.
What does she do?
She opposes what she calls sex privatization. That's the consequence of love. Love makes you attracted and devoted to one person, and that's a privatization of your sex. And
instead, we should all share it.
We should share it, perhaps with a group the size of a kibbutz, but not absolutely with anyone on the street.
You undoubtedly read about the Oneida colony run by what was his name, Noyes.
Yes.
In the middle of the 19th century in and around the town of Oneida in New York,
mm-hmm.
where essentially what they practiced was what I think they actually called sexual communism, the communal
yeah.
sexual practice that engaged and yeah. involved all the residents of
yeah.
of that utopian settlement.
Yes. Well, you can find it in Karl Marx and something like it even in Plato. So,
where do you find it in Plato?
Well, the communism of men and women, he says, in the best city, as well as the equality of the sexes. So,
do we find that in the Republic?
Yes, we find that in Plato's Republic.
Yeah.
It's love is something that attaches you to one person, and the Republic is devoted to justice. Justice means you must treat everyone equally and objectively. So love is a kind of enemy of justice. And I think the feminists believe that in their sort of less interesting, less philosophical way.
There is a sentence in the very introduction to your book, in the preface. I find it because I underlined it. You say, my book aims to comprehend the whole of maleness, but not to cover everything. One aspect omitted is homosexuality, a topic I leave to others. Why?
It's not something I know much about or have studied.
But if love, and particularly male-female love, is from the feminist point of view somehow baleful, then a possible answer is, for women, lesbianism, and indeed some of the leading feminists have advocated that, have they not?
I think that's true. They were lesbians, and they advocated it. I think both of those are true. You know, to be a lesbian means you don't have to deal with men. Men are such problems. So you can confine yourself to other women and escape perhaps the main problem of living with a man, namely the fact that he needs to feel important. Men have that ego about them, and women have to work around it. So if you have another woman, you escape that.
An interesting and somewhat eccentric social theorist in this country who perhaps had a greater audience a few years ago than he has now, but he's still very active, is George Gilder. Gilder did a book 20 years ago probably, but I remember reading it and talking with him about it, in which he argued essentially that men are dangerous yeah. to the society. There's too much aggression, there's too much wildness, there's too much risk-taking, some of the very qualities that you take to be definitive of yeah. manliness, and that what makes it all possible is the civilizing influence of women. De Gaulle spoke of France that it had en mission civilisatrice. Its mission is to civilize. Uh-huh. And Gilder argued the mission and the accomplishment of women is to civilize men.
I agree with that.
Do you?
Yes. Women are judges and critics of men. That's the way in which they are truly the second sex. When Simone de Beauvoir wrote her book, she meant that women are second rate compared to men.
Mm-hmm.
But a judge is someone who doesn't take up a question first, but listens to the parties, lets someone else take the initiative, and then brings the voice of wisdom to the matter. And I think that's what women are very good at. But they've lost that faculty because now they live in a gender-neutral society in which they want to be initiators too.
Is that in fact a burden, secretly providing pain, if only secretly confessed, to many women?
I would suspect so. Yes. Yeah. They really love to criticize, and they're very good at it. From such details as the necktie you're wearing, to much more important things.
Yeah. How does all of this bear upon that which is of great concern and has been the focus of your whole career, namely the question of the polis and how it can be properly and successfully governed? By polis I mean the community, whether it be the small, comparatively small town of Athens, or whether it be a great nation.
Manliness is right near the essence of politics, because a manly thing is not merely to be aggressive, but to be assertive. Assertive is aggression with a reason attached to it, a justification. So manly men take an issue. Let's say Martin Luther King took the issue of second class citizenship of blacks, which had long been neglected or left unremarked, and made an issue of it, brought it into public notice, and made it a political question. So manliness has that function of asserting the principles by which we live. And it does so in such a way as to oppose other people, or other peoples, or other parties, or other families, other groups, who are also led by men making their contrary assertions. So politics is a conflict of manly assertiveness.
Thus, the manly man, certainly in public life, runs high risks.
That's right. And he rather likes that. He prefers a situation in which his authority might be contested, in which he can prove himself over others, to one that's full of security, like a professor with tenure.
2 years ago, two years before his assassination, I took Martin Luther King to do an interview with Irving Kupcinet on Chicago television. As we exited the studio right in downtown Chicago, it was part of a larger operation, a march against the Vietnam War, I confess. As we exited the studios of Channel 7 in downtown Chicago, there was a phalanx of American Nazis in uniform, and yet others screaming for his death. And I and Ralph Abernathy and others stood with Martin Luther King going through a phalanx protected by police. And I thought to myself, he's going to be killed. Not today, but his fate is assassination.
Well, that was a manly moment, and he was a manly man.
Utterly. Utterly. Because he knew it. He must have. He knew that his life would not end peacefully in old age.
Yes, manliness doesn't like old age.
And the manly die young, do they?
A noble death at an early age.
Which brings us to Achilleus. You do much with the Iliad, and one remembers the wonderful opening lines. Sing, muse, the wrath of Achilles, Peleus' son, who brought a rain of woes upon the Achaeans.
Oh, that's quite wonderful. Yes, Achilles got angry because Agamemnon, his boss, stole his girlfriend, the slave girl that he'd won for himself. And Achilles' complaint was not so much, or not really, that this is what he had done. He was guilty of theft, but rather that he was not the sort of person who deserved to be the ruler. He had an escutcheon with an inheritance, whereas Achilles had a spear with manly virtue. And so Achilles took this slight, this small incident, and made a federal case of it, attacking the whole principle of the polis in which Agamemnon ruled.
But such men are dangerous.
Such men are dangerous, and that you see from the rest of the Iliad, which I think is perhaps designed to show that Achilles' definition of a ruler's virtue doesn't work.
Let me have about me sleek-headed men, such as Sleep of Night.
Yes.
Something like that from Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. There's a great inevitable paradox and intrinsic polarity in all of this. Manliness is desirable, is admirable, one would aspire to it, but Can we sustain it and can we live with it in an increasingly dangerous world? To put it in the cliched accents of our time, can we live with it when weapons of mass destruction are really weapons that can destroy civilization?
Well, we need manly men to oppose the evil manly men, I think.
Yeah.
And I think that's the answer. In danger, the danger is often produced by manliness, but it needs to be opposed by manliness.
And I must do my delayed and wimpish thing and pause for some commercials. We return almost directly to Harvey Mansfield and continuing our discussion based upon his new book, Manliness. There's so much one could talk with Harvey Mansfield about, drawing from this excellent new book, excellently written and provocatively thought through in a way that will fascinate any reader, whatever your initial persuasion concerning manliness and concerning, for that matter, gender equality. Your treatment of Plato, of Aristotle, of Nietzsche, of Rousseau, all of those may have to go by the board, time being short. And instead, I would ask you, since you work in the general discipline of political science, though at Harvard they prefer to call it the Department of Government, but I would ask you then to apply this, or show us how it does apply, to an analysis of the present political moment, or of this era in our own political, national, American political life.
Manliness is certainly controversial today. One of the points that's been made against my book is that we don't need to go back to manliness because we've got too much of it in the George Bush administration right now.
Manliness, mm-hmm. Monkey took us into a war we shouldn't have gone into, is the argument that is made.
Yes. So Bush is either over-manly, what his critics say, or manly, I think what his supporters would say. And either way, are quite manly. Now, in 2004, he opposed John Kerry, and Kerry wanted to come across as manly, but didn't fully succeed, I think, because he vacillated, or was seen or was shown to have vacillated. And that's not something a manly man would do. And in general, his position was difficult because he was a war hero in a war that he protested. So he had some difficulties in that respect, and so did Al Gore, who needed to have a fashion consultant, Naomi Wolf, show him how to dress in a way more appropriate to the alpha male.
And Naomi Wolf has announced her public public horror at your very book.
Oh, well, that's right. We had a nice discussion, indeed, some fireworks on C-SPAN about mm-hmm. a month ago.
Yeah.
Yes, I enjoyed that, although she spoke about 60% of the time, I would say. I don't think that a politician can be can succeed without being manly. And so I see Hillary as a formidable challenge to the Republicans, since I think she's a formidable woman. She's lived through a lot. And she's got herself elected senator from a large and important state. So I think she qualifies in that respect. Then there's, but I think the Democrats need to have someone who is manly because they're weak on the national security issue.
I see a more general problem. One thinks back to John F. Kennedy's a book titled Profiles in Courage. And the argument for that book is to meet the challenges and the opportunities of significant public office, one necessarily has to take high risks, the high risk of offending the constituency and maybe losing that office. But in fact, our politicians almost always, finally, are not willing to run that risk, but rather will surrender principle, will turn away from courageous representation of what they take to be the good if they fear electoral punition, as some political scientists call it.
Yes, I agree with that. I think that's very true.
And that's a built-in dilemma in democracy, is it not?
It is. Yes. It's very unmanly to take your lead from the people. But
vox populi, vox Dei est.
Yes, you have to do it.
The voice of the people is the voice of God.
So you have to reformulate it in such a way as to make it appear manly.
How do you do that?
Well, you might get out ahead of the people. But to do that, you have to take a risk that they might not follow you, or that what you get into, like this Iraq war, doesn't go well and people become restive. So, I think you're right that manliness is the difficulties of democratic leadership are wrapped up in how to be and how to appear manly.
But that brings to mind yet another figure, namely Benito Mussolini, who came to power arguing that democracy and an attempt to please the people is ultimately ruinous for a nation that has high aspirations, and that proper political leadership requires essentially asserting your power over the weak-minded mass and leading them and forcing them, and we put aside all the fool's play of democratic process.
Yes, but then the people are expected to follow.
Yeah.
So.
And so
yes,
they did. So,
yes, indeed they did. He was a laughable fellow, though. His wonderful statement: "Better to live 1 hour like a lion than 100 years like a sheep."
I think sounds manly.
Yeah.
It's a caricature of man.
Yes, it is a caricature. and he with his tight-fitting uniform and his big, fat, shaven face is a very picture of manly boastfulness.
You're very interested in Tocqueville, and indeed you've done translation and much commentary.
Yes.
On Tocqueville. He saw these problems, and he saw them represented in early American life, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Tocqueville believed that there was a kind of democratic manliness. You might easily think that manliness is aristocratic, because a manly man has more ego than most others.
Then we come to the payoff question. What is democratic manliness, or what is the role of manliness in a truly democratic society?
Frankness, man to man. This is in Tocqueville. A democratic society is one where you live among equals instead of among superiors and inferiors. With superiors and inferiors, you always have to be careful what you say, you know, in front of the children or in front of the boss. But in a democracy, you can level with people, as we say. And that's a democratic manliness, and maybe that's the way a democracy would want to live.
Do we have exemplars of that approach in American political life? I know you find them in American film,
yes.
But that's easier.
Yes. Well, the greatest example is Teddy Roosevelt.
Yes.
Again, not a Mussolini at all, but a slight caricature of the manly man. Who spoke in terms of urgent exhortation to the American people. And most of all, he demanded manly virtues. You mustn't shrink and you mustn't shirk. Those were his two favorite verbs.
What did one make of his cousin, Franklin?
Well, very manly, too. To overcome that terrible disease,
and
to take us through such perilous times, the Depression and the Second World War, and to do so with that wonderful, confidence-inspiring voice, such warmth, such authority, and yet very close somehow to the American people. Yes, he's a picture of democratic manliness.
And as I think of what we've had beyond that time, well, I guess our more modern presidents have varied in that regard. Truman was manly in
very
some significant
manly,
way,
yes,
wasn't he?
In his clipped way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not always refined. Reagan was manly, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And in a gentlemanly sort of way that others... other presidents haven't been able to imitate.
What does one make of that most enigmatic and fascinating of modern political figures in the history of this country, Bill Clinton?
Yes. On the one hand, manly in a low way, and also in a sort of middle way because he inspired authority, unmanly because he loved to schmooze and loved to be loved.
Loved to be loved.
Loves to be loved, yeah.
That's
not good for manliness, no.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Instead, face the music.
Yes.
And pay the costs.
That's right. And face them down.
Fascinating. We are due for another round of commercials, and with the time that's left, we very much would welcome telephone calls. We're opening the lines at this instant and look forward to your questions, contributions, your opinions for that matter, as long as they are related to what you've heard so far or to other things you find in the book if you've already been reading Manliness by Harvey Mansfield. 591-7200, as ever, the number, 591-7200. Get your calls in instantly if you want to be heard, time being short, but also we're happy to, as usual, invite email contributions from those listening, particularly on the internet at some greater distance. The email address, extension720@tribune.com. extension720@tribune, tribune.com, or 591-7200. Get those calls and emails in instantly, and we shall be with you directly after this. And in the time remaining, directly to your calls and or email to Harvey C. Mansfield, a professor of government at Harvard University and author of the challenging and very important new book, Manliness, that published by Yale University Press. 591-7200 is the number, and you are the first caller. Good evening.
Good evening, Mr. Rosenberg and Mansfield. Fascinating talk. Bringing up the Iliad, I was wondering what you might have to say about Hector facing down Achilles after running around and turning to face him eventually. In contrast to Achilles, who's half-god.
Yes, you might take Hector as a greater example of manliness than Achilles, but Achilles died young, and he raised the issue of Agamemnon's rule, and so that's what interested me about him, the political importance of Achilles.
Okay, well, thank you.
We thank you, sir. Glad to have heard from you, and let's go quickly to another. 591-7200. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi. My question for Professor Mansfield is whether manliness exists in his own work, which is Academia, because he talked about the professor who impressed everyone by his manliness, but yet in his book he mentions that professors aren't manly in the sense that they shrink from contest and shirk their duty.
A very welcome question.
Yeah.
I'm very interested in your response to it.
Professors show their manliness in their footnotes. That's where they take on their enemies and carry on polemics and try out their manliness. But it's quite unmanly to have lifetime security, which is what a professor has. And my observation is that the more security you have, the more concern you have for security. And so that I'm not quite sure that tenure works, academic tenure works to produce the sort of courage that one would like to see in a professor.
At your own university, not an inconsequential one in this country, we've had an exhibition of manliness displayed, injured, rejected, and essentially abandoned in the presidential follies at Harvard only over the last two or three years.
That's true with Larry Summers. Larry Summers is a manly man, but he did a very unmanly thing. He made a perfectly reasonable statement about the lesser talent of of women in science than men at the highest, we're talking about the highest level.
He didn't even assert that. He said it may be,
yes,
that may be the case.
He was talking about it. That's all he was doing, yes. And suggested that an inquiry be made. I think a position that he could have defended after making some apologies for his abruptness, perhaps. But he never did that. He began apologizing and kept on and apologized for a whole year, at the end of which he was fired.
Well, he apologized because there was an immediate arousal of feminist rage.
There was.
At the very occasion, yeah, for closed meeting at which he made this statement.
There certainly was, and that rage was expressed in a way that one would recognize as a traditional womanly stereotype.
But a few friends of mine at Harvard, one of them, Alan Dershowitz, who said this to me only recently, have noted that it was a minority that drove him out. That not all the women at Harvard felt this way, surely, and by no means did all of the male professors feel this way, but in essence, it was a minority portion of the arts and sciences faculty, or the arts and, was it science? No, it wasn't even sciences, the arts and letters faculty, essentially.
Arts and sciences, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And that the least manly aspect of the whole dismal matter was that people didn't stand up, as you did, I know, at Harvard, stand up in defense of the president.
That's also true. But it's hard to defend someone who doesn't defend himself. So
yes,
his Summers promoters and his defenders were disheartened and discouraged by this.
He had given it away by first apologizing, yeah, and then apologizing, and then re-apologizing, yeah, and also by trying to buy them off,
yes,
with... What was it?
Yes, a $50 million package of benefits for the feminist women on our faculty, as if they were suffering from lack of benefits.
If he had stood truly manly in the face of this onslaught, how might it have worked out otherwise?
I think he would have won. In any case, even if a majority had gone against him, he would have worked himself up to enough confidence that he would have continued.
Or even if he were defeated, he could have made a manly exit by quoting the old country song, "Take this job and shove it."
That too, yeah, that would have been a wonderful way to leave. As it is, he wrote a letter that was graceful, but no longer apologetic, but it was the work of a defeated man.
A sad saga, really.
It is sad.
Back to the phones, 591-7200. You are next on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. I confess I haven't read the book, and I should have, but I hear an awful lot about this author, Robert Bly, and the book Iron John, and I really don't know anything about it, but I wonder if the author has, or the guest tonight has something that he could share about the manliness or the content of that book. And I thank you, and I'll hang up and listen for a response.
All right, sir. We thank you for the call.
That was an extremely successful book. And so I don't want to sound envious, but I do have a criticism or two of it. I think that manly men shouldn't complain. That was a book of complaint. Also, he identifies manliness with something primitive. That is...
They went out into the forest and banged on drums, as I
yes.
remember.
Yes. That's not totally wrong, but I don't think that's the main truth about manliness. Manliness is something which is still with us. It's in our nature. As long as men are here, there's going to be manliness.
I read an email. We are witnessing media reports of how, quote, feminism has lost its way, or, quote, feminism has achieved its goals. Does this bode well for the return of manliness in some form? This is really a question, I guess, about what is the state of feminism as complementary to, quote, manliness.
I think we need a new feminism, a feminism that has come to terms with manliness, and also a feminism that's closer to the natural inclinations of women, especially in regard to domesticity and to sex, sexual modesty. I think... women's domestic inclinations are very much understated, underrated by traditional feminism. And feminism has made an alliance with sexual liberation in a way that I believe is very disadvantageous to women.
I'm reminded suddenly of an excellent book of smaller scope, but by a very young person, Wendy Shalit's book, Modesty. Do you know it?
Yes, I do. And I know her, yes. That's a very fine book.
Yeah. We go back to the phones. Time short, but we'll work in one or two more quick calls on 591-7200. And you are next on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. Very interesting discussion. I would like your thoughts on the idea of, your opinion, the ideal society. Would you see that being set by the attributes of manliness, sort of uncontrolled, much like a free market would leave supply and demand to set the economic society? Or what would be the best way to control or artificially regulate manliness for the, I guess ideally, for the good of all, as opposed to just those with manliness?
I don't think that manliness should be allowed to go uncontrolled. I think that's the caller's implication, and I certainly agree.
Well, or your views on what's the best way to have controls.
Well, we need to go back to some of the womanly virtues, because it's women who traditionally have been the best critics of manliness. And they do this not with general statements in the way that the feminists do, but with specific criticisms of their man, the man they love. That's a woman is the best critic of every manly man, but it has to be his woman.
Time is just about gone. My thanks to that caller, and please indulge me within the space of a minute or two at the most with response to this. I am disheartened as a sort of a veteran presence in this culture, a veteran participant in it, at the general degradation, amorality, true nihilism, and the low estate of our public life, as conveyed whether in the media or as conveyed even in politics, and in the rundown, or rather decline, of the quality of our educational system. I'm not too optimistic about this country. Are you?
I'm an American, so I always try to be optimistic, but it's more difficult now. I agree with you. And our education, especially our higher education, needs to reform itself. Larry Summers, I had great hopes for, because it seemed to me that he was going in that direction. But just because he was so outstanding, he was humiliated and brought down by truly malign forces at Harvard.
Will others who can do the work better rise to replace him, if not at Harvard, in American academic life generally?
I hope so, but I'm afraid that Larry Summers has blown the opportunity for others as well as for himself.
I fear that that is the case, and thus it's a significantly sad and defeating recent history that has been enacted at Harvard.
My belief is that Harvard is on the way down.
Yeah, but you're still there, which is one of more graceful aspects, or you grace the place more fully than some of your colleagues do.
That's good of you to say.
It's quite sincerely meant, as is with equal sincerity my endorsement of the fine new book by Harvey Mansfield, titled directly, Manliness, Yale University Press, the publishers.